From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today we mourn those who died this morning on American Airlines Flight 587. Today is also Veterans Day, a day to honor all those who died defending the United States. Veterans Day originated in commemoration of the end of World War I. We'll hear how that war changed the world from historian Neil Ferguson. We'll also hear a reading of the letters Winston Churchill and his wife wrote to one another while Churchill fought in that war. Also, we listened back to an interview with Ken Kesey. He died Saturday at the age of 66. And book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the Jonathan Franz and Oprah Winfrey controversy and reviews Jennifer Egan's new novel, Look at Me. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stasio. New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani now says 6 to 8 people were killed on the ground, along with 260 people on board an American Airlines jetliner that crashed this morning. It had been reported there were only 255 people on that plane, but American Airlines officials now say there were 5 infants on board as well. The plane was en route to the Dominican Republic when it broke apart minutes after takeoff from Kennedy Airport in New York. The Airbus A300 plunged into the Rockaway neighborhood of Queens, New York. Several homes were immediately engulfed in flames. As bad as it was, Mayor Giuliani says the crash could have been an even greater disaster.
When we went up in the helicopter and saw it, it was amazing how the plane just landed in one small defined area, as opposed to hitting a number of homes.
NPR's Jackie Lydon spoke with residents in the Queens neighborhood where the plane went down.
People in this area are really traumatized and somber, as you might imagine. I talked to people who live just a block away from where the engine and pieces of this flight came down. And the most immediate feeling, of course, is it could have been me. And then beyond that, why this area? So many people have already been lost in this area, firefighters and police officers. And people here are really feeling deeply traumatized.
NPR's Jackie Lydon in Rockaway Beach. As many as 100 investigators from the National Transportation Safety Board have converged on the site of today's crash. The FBI is also involved. So far, no signs that their crash was involved or linked to terrorism. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The NTSB has already recovered the plane's flight data recorder. That device has been taken to the agency's headquarters in Washington, D.C. That data recorder could reveal valuable information about just what was happening inside the plane just before the crash. Was there a problem with the engines? Were the plane's wing flaps set correctly? Investigators will combine that information with clues they hope to gather from the wreckage. Pieces of the A300 Airbus are scattered over a wide area. Some landed in the waters of Jamaica Bay. An engine landed in a gas station. Officials have been at pains to emphasize they have no firm clues to explain the crash and that there are no obvious links to terrorism. Investigators say they have yet to locate the cockpit voice recorder, but ground controllers say there's no evidence of any distress call from the plane. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
The death toll is rising in Algeria, where last week's torrential rains have taken at least 600 lives. The interior minister says an unknown number of people are missing. At least 4,000 families are homeless. Most of the deaths occurred in a working-class neighborhood where buildings collapsed from rain and sliding mud that inundated the streets. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 53 points to close at 95.53. The Nasdaq was up 11 points, finishing the day at 18.40. You're listening to NPR News. On the ground in Afghanistan, there are reports of dramatic gains made by U.S.-backed opposition forces. U.S. soldiers were seen near the front lines as anti-Taliban troops approached the capital, Kabul. NPR's Ivan Watson is traveling with the Northern Alliance, about 40 miles north of Kabul. He says the opposition forces have advanced quickly.
This has been a very victorious 3 days, unprecedented for the Northern Alliance, which has been losing ground, which was almost destroyed 2 months ago when its military leader, Ahmed Shah Massoud, was assassinated by suicide bombers. In fact, the Northern Alliance foreign minister, as well as frontline commanders, said today that this is a day of remembrance for Massoud, who was the true leader, the spirit, many say, of the Northern Alliance, that he fought for so many years against the Taliban and was not here to see this victory, as the Northern Alliance captured Mazar-i-Sharif in the northwest, captured towns in the northeast, and then also moved to the gates of the Afghan capital, Kabul, all in the space of just 4 days.
NPR's Ivan Watson reporting from just outside Kabul, Afghanistan. Amnesty International released a report today urging that an international observer team be sent to the Middle East to help bring calm to the West Bank. After 13 months of Israeli-Palestinian violence, Amnesty International accused both sides of human rights violations. Israel repeatedly has rejected calls for international monitors to the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip, fearing they would serve as a shield for Palestinian militants. However, the Palestinians welcomed Amnesty International's findings, calling the report a strong condemnation against Israeli occupiers. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing Novasoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Today we mourn those who died this morning on American Airlines Flight 587. Today is also the day that we honor all those who have fought in defense of the United States. Veterans Day originated as Armistice Day in commemoration of the end of World War I. Historian Neil Ferguson is the author of The Pity of War, Explaining World War I. It's about how the First World War changed the nature of war and changed the world. About 10 million people died in the First World War between the years 1914 and 1918. About 20 million were wounded. Ferguson is British. He says that the First World War was worse for his country than the Second. For example, more British soldiers were killed in World War I than World War II. I asked him for other examples.
Well, I think one could make a general statement, which would probably be true of all the European states, namely that the First World War was a bigger shock. When the Second World War came along, there was a very clear memory of what war was like. No one had any illusions about the enormous loss of life that would arise in the event of a major European war. Whereas in 1914, it's clear that only the real specialists, the military planners, the people who understood what heavy artillery could do, really grasped in 1914 what a European war meant. And I think for that reason, the trauma, the caesura is that much greater. The difference between pre-war and post-war is somehow greater in the case of the First World War than it is in the case of the Second World War, when everybody knows that they're letting themselves in for hell when war breaks out.
Would you describe a little bit about what the Western Front was like, what the trench warfare of the day was like?
Well, trench warfare was a kind of return to siege warfare in one sense, namely from a very early stage, really from the early days of 1915, the positions on the Western Front were pretty much fixed. Very little territorial change occurred until the spring of 1918, and in the rest of 1918, the war became a war of movement again. So for most of the war, the front is very static, much more than on the Eastern Front, where there's much greater mobility. And that means that the common experience of combat on the Western Front was that you sat in a hole in the ground and you hoped that the shells wouldn't hit you. Most people, the majority of people, are killed by artillery shells. They're not killed in action by bayonets or rifles. And indeed, going over the top into action on an offensive is an exceptional experience. So it's a very sedentary war, and it's an extremely nerve-wracking war, because I think it's safe to say that the experience of being bombed, of being shelled for hours at a time in these massive artillery bombardments which went on the Western Front was probably one of the worst experiences a human being could have in the 20th century. Even if you survived it, your nerves were completely shattered.
Well, would you describe one of the battles that had massive casualties?
Well, for the British point of view, the most notorious battle is the Battle of the Somme, with Passchendaele as a close second. The Battle of the Somme happens in 1916. In the summer of 1916, a massive army has been accumulated and is sent towards German positions over the relatively flat battlefield of the Somme. Not a particularly good place to fight a battle, but chosen because it was close to the French, and the French seemed to need some support.
And for reasons which are intimately bound up with the lack of British preparation for the war, the fact that there simply hadn't been a big British army in 1914, that almost everybody who goes over the top in 1916 has been very hurriedly trained, and because the army itself does not really have a theory of how you fight this kind of war, they march pretty slowly and steadily towards German machine gun emplacements, which have been more or less unscathed by the preceding bombardment. Now, the effect of the bombardment, which the British commander, Haig, firmly believed would shatter German resistance, was simply to warn the Germans what was going to happen next. The Germans had dug themselves in deep. When the shells stopped, up they came from their emplacements, took up their machine guns, and they simply mowed down the advancing British soldiers. And the casualties on the first day alone number tens and tens of thousands. The numbers killed in the whole of the Battle of the Somme, which lasted for several months, for Britain were greater than the number of Americans killed in the whole Vietnam War.
That's pretty amazing figures. The First World War resulted in a lot of terrific literature, much of it anti-war literature. You quote Ernst Jünger's diary of a German front line at Guillemont in August of 1916, and he writes, "Among the living lay the dead. As we dug ourselves in, we found them in layers, stacked up one on top of another. One company after another had been shoved into the drum fire and steadily annihilated." You also have a lot of pretty gruesome photographs in the book from World War One, but the photograph I actually found most shocking was a photograph of Scottish troops wearing kilts. And I'm thinking, wow, this is like fighting trench warfare in a skirt. It astounded me.
It astounded the Germans, too. One of the things that German writers about the war, men like Jünger, often commented upon was the particular aggressiveness and ferocity of the Scottish regiments, who were instantly recognizable by their kilts. The kilt was only abandoned as frontline dress relatively late in the war, when it was realized that when poison gas was released, Scottish soldiers suffered disproportionately because the gas got under their kilts and inflicted terrible burns. But for most of the war, the Scottish Highland regiments wore the kilt, and the Germans called them divils in skirts, or the women from hell, because they were very distinctive in the way that they dressed. They were also distinctive in the way that they fought. And it's clear that the Scottish regiments not only suffered the highest casualties of any army in the war, but also probably inflicted pretty hefty casualties on the Germans. They were renowned for the ferocity of their conduct in action. And it's clear that, for example, Scottish regiments were involved in the incidents of prisoner killing, which I detail in one of the chapters in the books. This is important because my grandfather was in one of these regiments, and I suppose I would never have written the book had it not been for the realization that as a teenager, my own grandfather had been in the Seaforth Highlanders and had been one of those young men that you see in the plates in the book, sitting in a trench waiting to go over the top and kill Germans.
Do you know if he wore a kilt when he was in battle?
Yes, he did. I still have it.
Did you talk with him about that?
I was very young when he died. I was about 4 or 5 when my grandfather died, so I don't have clear recollections of the kind of conversations that I would love to have with him now, where he's still alive. But he talked enough with my father about it for me to have a reasonably good idea of what his war was like. Unlike the famous war poets and war novelists, nothing survives of my grandfather's war on paper, just a box full of a couple of medals and a small Bible. But the memories he passed down through my father to me were enough for me to reconstruct more or less what he went through.
What's one of those memories that your father shared with you?
It seems pretty likely that my grandfather was there when the Germans launched their final all-out offensive in the spring of 1918, which very nearly won the war, because he described the experience of seeing the advancing German infantry and preparing to be sent into action against them, and feeling absolutely certain that this was it, because the Germans at this point seemed quite unstoppable. And at the very last minute, a neighboring unit was sent over instead of his unit, and he was pretty sure that that decision had saved his life. And that's one of the kind of stories that is etched on my memory from my days as a small boy.
How do you think World War One affected your family's feelings about war?
I think it had a very profound effect on Scotland because of this very high mortality rate. My own school was dedicated as a war memorial after the war was over, and so I went to school every day passing the war memorial, which had these, in these huge letters, "Say not that the brave die." And I always used to think to myself, well, hang on, they did die, brave or not brave. And I certainly, as a schoolboy, was strongly attracted to the anti-war message of poets like Wilfred Owen, whom I was encouraged to read by my teachers. And I think my own family certainly were liberals with a pretty strong pacifist streak. There was certainly no appetite for another war or any more war in my family. And when my other grandfather had to go and fight in the Second World War, he ended up fighting the Japanese in Asia, it was with no great enthusiasm and a deep sense of resignation. And I think for me, coming to terms with this family memory is part of the reason for writing the book. Not least because I began to realize that the anti-war literature wasn't really the whole truth. In some ways, it's a rather unrepresentative take on the frontline experience. I mean, you mentioned Ernst Jünger, but Ernst Jünger is not an anti-war writer. When you read Jünger's account of being on the Western Front, it's constantly referring to the exhilaration of military experience, of the front experience. And for people like Jünger, or more notoriously, for soldiers like the young Adolf Hitler, the First World War wasn't just a hellish experience. That at the same time that it was hellish, it was also a supreme test of their manhood, of their inner strength, and the friendships and comradeship of the front was something which lived on in their imaginations after the war.
Historian Neil Ferguson recorded in 1999 after the publication of his book The Pity of War, Explaining World War I. Coming up, letters written between Winston Churchill and his wife Clementine during World War I. This is Fresh Air. Today we observe Veterans Day, a holiday that originated as Armistice Day in commemoration of the signing of the armistice ending World War I. Winston Churchill started his military career during that war. We're going to hear some of the letters Churchill and his wife Clementine wrote one another during World War I. Their letters were read by historian and writer Simon Schama, whose latest book is called The History of Britain. His reading was part of an event held last month at Town Hall in New York in response to September 11th to benefit the September 11th Fund. The event was produced by the New Yorker magazine and was called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. Here's writer Simon Schama.
You need to know two things about the letters I'm going to read. Winston Churchill, who loved America deeply and passionately, whose mother was American, began 1914 as the First Lord of the Admiralty and ended 1915 as a major in the trenches. From Winston Spencer Churchill to Clementine Churchill, 28th July 1914, midnight, the Admiralty. My darling one and beautiful, everything trends towards catastrophe and collapse. I'm interested, geared up, and happy. Is it not horrible to be built like that? The preparations have a hideous fascination for me. I pray to God to forgive me for such fearful moods of levity. Yet I would do my best for peace, and nothing would induce me wrongfully to strike the blow. I cannot feel that we in this island are in any serious degree responsible for the wave of madness which has swept the mind of Christendom. No one can measure the consequences. I wondered whether those stupid kings and emperors could not assemble together and revivify kingship by saving the nations from hell. But we all drift on in a kind of dull, cataleptic trance, as if it was somebody else's operation. The two black swans on St. James's Park have as darling signet, gray, fluffy, precious, unique. I watched them this evening for some time as a relief from all the plans and schemes. We are putting the whole Navy into fighting trim, and all seems quite sound and thorough. And we are awake to the tips of our fingers, but war is the unknown and the unexpected. God guard us and our long accumulated inheritance. You know how willingly and proudly I would risk or give, if need be, my period of existence to keep this country great and famous and prosperous and free. But the problems are very difficult. One has to try to measure the indefinite and weigh the imponderable. My darling one, ring me up at fixed times, but talk in parables, for they all listen. Kiss those kittens, his children. Kiss those kittens and be loved forever only by me, your own W. 19th of November, 1915. Clementine Spencer Churchill, 41 Cromwell Road. My darling Winston, I long for news of you. I want to know where you are, what your billet is like, whether you're comfortable, what you've had to eat, whether you are happy, my dear one, what you are thinking and feeling. Yesterday I sent after you khaki trousers and shirts, which arrived after you departed. Do you get the newspapers quite easily, or shall I order them for you? Although it's only a few miles, you seem to me as far away as the stars, lost among a million khaki figures. Write to me, Winston. I want a letter from you, badly. Your loving Clemmy. Winston Spencer Churchill to Clementine Spencer Churchill, 23rd of November, 1915, Boudeville, France. My darling, we have finished our first 48 hours in the trenches and are now resting in billets and support. We are near enough to hear rifle fire, but out of range of everything except the artillery, which will not be likely to bother about the cottages and farms where we are living. I've spent the morning on my toilet and a hot bath engineered with some difficulty. When a battalion is in the trenches, we live about 1,000 yards behind in a dugout in rear of a shattered farm. I spent Sunday night in the trenches themselves instead with Griggs's company, and when we go in again tomorrow night, I'm going to stay with them for the whole period. This gives me the opportunity of seeing and learning thoroughly. It's not more dangerous than at battalion headquarters because walks to and from the trenches over an area where stray bullets are skimming are avoided. It is a wild scene. The lines of trenches, or rather breastworks we are now holding, is built along the ruins of other older lines taken from the Germans. The guards are cleaning everything and work night and day to strengthen the parapets and improve the shelter. Filth and rubbish everywhere, graves built into the defenses and scattered about promiscuously, feet and clothing breaking through the soil, water, muck on all sides. And about this scene, in dazzling moonlight, troops of enormous rats creep and glide to the unceasing accompaniment of rifle and machine guns and the venomous whining and whirring of the bullets which pass overhead. Amid these surroundings, aided by wet and cold and every minor discomfort, I found happiness and comfort, such as I have not known. Will you now send, regularly, once a week, a small box of food to supplement the rations? Sardines, chocolates, potted meats, and other things which may strike your fancy. Begin as soon as possible. Do you realize what a very important person a major is? 99 people out of 100 in this great army have to touch their hats to me. With this inspiring reflection, let me sign myself, your loving and devoted husband, Winston. Kiss Randolph, Diana, and that golden Sarah for me. Clementine Spencer Churchill to Winston Spencer Churchill. 12th of January, 1916, 41 Cromwell Road. My own darling, I long so to be able to comfort you. Later on, when you are in danger in the trenches, you will be equable and contented, while I, who am now comparatively at ease, will be in mortal anxiety. Try not to brood too much. I would be so unhappy if your naturally open and unsuspicious nature became embittered. Patience is the only grace you need. If you're not killed, as sure as day follows night, you will come into your own again. I know you don't fear death. It is I who dread that. But I'm almost glad to be suffering because I'm sure no single soul will be allowed to live through this time without sorrow. So perhaps what we are enduring now will be counted, and we shall be spared the greatest pain of all. When it's all over, we'll be proud you're a soldier and not a politician for the greater part of the war. Soldiers and soldiers' wives seem to me now the only real people. I'm glad you tell me all you feel, darling. I want to know it all. I, too, show a detached and smiling face to the world. I wish I had some interesting news for you. Goodbye, my darling. I send you my kisses. Your loving Clemmy. Do you want any more cigars?
Simon Schama reading letters written by Winston Churchill and his wife Clementine. Schama's latest book is called The History of Britain. His reading was recorded October 11th at New York's Town Hall in a program called Beyond Words, New Yorker Writers Read the Work of Others. The event was presented by The New Yorker magazine to benefit the September 11th fund. Our thanks to The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, saluting cultural programming on NPR, recipient of the Year 2000 National Medal of Arts. And from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publishers of Stephen Hawking's The Universe in a Nutshell, the sequel to A Brief History of Time. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we remember Ken Kesey, the novelist and prankster, died Saturday at the age of 66. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan considers the Jonathan Franzen-Oprah Winfrey controversy and reviews Jennifer Egan's new novel, Look at Me. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're going to remember Ken Kesey. He died Saturday at the age of 66. He had liver cancer. Kesey wrote two novels that were very popular in the 60s. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is set in a mental institution where the patients rebel against the sterile, repressive hospital regimen. Sometimes a Great Notion is set in Oregon logging country. But Kesey became even better known in the 60s as one of the first people to bring the experimental hallucinogen LSD out of the research laboratory and into the counterculture. Kesey and his friends, known as the Merry Pranksters, were among the first and most celebrated of the West Coast hippies. In the book The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Tom Wolfe described the escapades of Kesey and the Pranksters as they drove around the country in their day-glow school bus. The driver was usually Neil Cassady, who was immortalized as the character Dean Moriarty in Jack Kerouac's novel On the Road. I spoke with Ken Kesey in 1989 after the publication of Caverns, a collaborative novel written by the students in his writing class at the University of Oregon. You'd studied with Wallace Stegner at Stanford. And you write that in your university days, he mistook you for an anti-intellectual, but what you really were was a near illiterate. Elaborate on that.
Well, as I told you, I majored in radio and television. I knew Fibber McGee and Molly and Jack Benny, but I wasn't too well versed in Faulkner and William Blake. Those were new things to me. When I got down to Stanford, I realized that I was not nearly as well read as most of the other people in the class.
Were you uncomfortable about that? Did you feel like you had all this catching up to do?
I felt like a country fool walked in with stuff between my toes, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're living on your farm now.
Same old farm, yeah.
You know, it's funny, in your prankster days, you were seen as being part of a group that had made such a break with the past. And yet here you are living on a family farm. It had been owned by someone else in your family before you. You're, I believe, still married to the woman who you've been married to since, what is it, 1956?
Long time, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's been this incredible continuity in your life between past and present in a lot of ways.
Well, old Tommy Wolfe has a lot to do with that misconception. You know, it's like coming over here tonight. We got out there in the traffic, and we come in here late. And I just hate to come into a place late because I know that's what they expect of me, you know, because of my prankster upbringing. I know that, yeah, here he is. He's late. He's probably messed up. But I'm not. I've always been a fairly reliable, straight-up-the-middle-of-the-road citizen that just happens to be an acid head.
You say that you blame Tommy Wolfe for these misconceptions about you. You're referring to Tom Wolfe's book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. Did you like the book?
Oh, yeah, it's a good book. Yeah.
And do you feel... Yeah, go ahead.
Wolf's a genius. He did a lot of that stuff. He's only around 3 weeks. He picked up that amount of dialogue and verisimilitude without tape recorder, without taking notes to any extent. He just watches very carefully and remembers. But, you know, he's got his own editorial filter there, and so what he's coming up with is part of me, but it's not all of me, you know, any more than Hunter S. Thompson is loaded all the time and shooting machine guns at John Denver. That's the sort of thing that, interesting in the media, but he's got a lot more life to him than that.
What effect did the electric Kool-Aid acid test have on you? For instance, did it make the police feel more determined to try to bust you again?
Yeah, but I haven't been worried about the cops that much. The effect Kool-Aid acid test has is it's as though, say, that you're Richard Gere and you got a great big wart on the side of your nose, and they begin to play it up in the cameras, and then pretty soon it becomes a thing that a lot of teenage girls are in love with, and then pretty soon you're looking at it too until you're cross-eyed looking at your own wart.
Why do you use the wart as an analogy?
Well, because I was a lot more than the Tom Wolfe depiction, and I think this is a problem for a lot of American writers and has been for a long time. You know, Hemingway, he doesn't really get into trouble until he becomes dazzled by his own image. He sees the rest of the United States looking at him, and he moves over and sits there, and he looks at himself, too. And then when he tries to go back and get inside of his own skin, he can't quite fit into it as well as he used to. He's gained weight. He can't put his own skin back on. And when you're writing, it's not a good idea to be observed too much, unless you want to live in New York and wear white clothes. If you really are interested in being a real straight, old-fashioned writer, it's better to live down in Mississippi like Faulkner and work out in the woodshed and not be seen but once every 10 years. I think that being the observed always turns your eye back on yourself and you become kind of blinded by your own radiance.
You started doing LSD through a government experiment, an experimental program, and I think it was 1959. And you were one of the volunteers who volunteered to take this experimental drug and have it tested on yourself. How did you become a volunteer for these experiments?
One of the guys that was our neighbors was a psychologist, and he was supposed to show up one day and just really didn't have the common hair to do it, and says, "Would anybody else like to take my place?" And I, at the time, was training for the Olympics. I made it to be an alternate in the 1960 Olympics team and was in
good
shape.
As a wrestler?
Yeah, as a wrestler. I'd never been drunk on beer, you know, let alone done any drugs, but this is the American government. They said, "Come in here. We've just discovered this new spot of space, and we want somebody to go up there and look it over, and we don't want to do it. We want to hire you students." And I was one of 140 or so that it eventually turned out. It was CIA-sponsored. I didn't believe it for a long time. Well, Allen Ginsberg says, "You know who was paying for that? It was the CIA." I said, "Oh, no, Allen, you're just paranoid." But he finally got all the darn records, and it did turn out the CIA was doing this, and it wasn't being done to try to cure insane people, which is what we thought. It was being done to try to make people insane, to weaken people and to be able to put them under the control of interrogators. This didn't, we didn't find this out for 20 years. And by that time, the government had said, "Okay, stop that experiment. All these guinea pigs that we've sent up there into outer space, bring them back down, and don't ever let them go back up there again because we don't like the look in their eyes."
Do you remember what your very first trip was like when you were a volunteer in this government program? And what kind of preparation were you given for it? Were you given any?
None at all, except I'd read a little piece in Life magazine about how they'd given it to cats, and cats were afraid of mice once they'd had LSD. But I think that we'd been preparing for a long time. You know, I knew the Bible. I knew the Bhagavad Gita. I knew the Tao Te Ching. I had read Hermann Hesse's Journey to the East, which gave us an underpinning spiritually so that these phenomena that were happening to us had something that we could relate to. I think a lot of people who were just jumping into drugs now, they don't have anything to relate it to. And I think people have been, for one thing, people have been doing psychedelics for thousands and thousands of years, trying to find out what's on the real books. And we just happened to come at a time when it was not only a lot of stuff happening chemically, there was a lot of new changes in music and in film. Burroughs was just beginning to do his work in literature. There was a movement afoot that this was just a part of, and It was exciting. It was wonderful.
What was that very first trip like, though, under the experimental conditions?
Groovy, man. It was groovy. We suddenly realized that there's a lot more to this world than we previously thought. I think, because I'm asked this question a lot, it's been 20 years or so, and people are always coming back saying, "Well, what do you think?" And one of the things that I think came out of it is this, is that there's room. We don't all have to be the same. We don't have to have Baptists coast to coast. We can throw in some Buddhists and some Christians and people who are just thinking totally strange thoughts about the Irish leprechauns, that there is room spiritually for everybody in this universe.
We're listening to a 1989 interview with Ken Kesey. He died Saturday. We'll hear more of the interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Ken Kesey died Saturday. He was the author of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and was one of the first people to bring LSD out of the research lab and into the counterculture. He died Saturday at the age of 66. Let's get back to our 1989 interview.
You were among the first people to take LSD out of the clinical setting and use it in a social setting. How did you first get it out?
Of the hospital?
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, after I'd gone through these drug experiments and was in this little room in the hospital, looking out through the little window at the people out there who were the regular nuts, they weren't students going through experiments, looking at them through my crazed eyes, I saw that these people have something going and there's a truth to it that people are missing. And that's how I came to write Cuckoo's Nest. I got a job at the Nut House and worked from midnight to 8, writing that book and taking care of these patients on this one ward, and made a lot of good friends, some that I still have. And I found that my key opened a lot of the doors to the doctor's offices where these drugs were being kept. That's how.
Huh. And then you had friends who were able to make it in their own laboratories.
Yeah, but they never was anywhere as good as that good government stuff. That's the government. The CIA always has the best stuff.
You know, you brought up Cuckoo's Nest, and I was wondering, when you were working in the psychiatric ward, which is what Cuckoo's Nest is based on, and I think you sometimes went in there high on hallucinogenics, do you think you ended up writing Cuckoo's Nest in a way, projecting your experiences as a quote, sane person high on drugs, projecting those experiences onto people who maybe had, like, serious problems?
Well, these people that had serious problems, I mean, I saw people hallucinating and people in bad shape.
Mm-hmm.
Make no mistake about it. Being crazy is painful, and being crazy is hell, whether you get it from taking a drug or whether it happens because you're just trying to lead the American way of life and it keeps kicking your legs out from under you. One way or another, it's hell on you, and it's nothing that's fun about it, and I am certainly not recommending it. It is a lens through which I looked at stuff, but it's hard on the eyes. But I think I had a very valid viewpoint, and much closer than a lot of the doctors were having. At that time, you know, everything was Freudian. If you were messed up, it was because of something that had happened to you when you were in the bathroom as a kid. And with these experiences, and I don't just mean drug experiences, there were a lot of other things that were going on that were emphasizing this. John Coltrane's music was saying the same thing. It was saying something is wrong and it's making us a little crazy, and that is making us crazy enough to hallucinate, whether we were promoting it ourselves or it was being imposed on us. I don't want to argue that now, but when I felt so good after being on there all night to know that I was wearing a green uniform, and I mean a white uniform instead of a green uniform, so I could leave in the morning and go home. Otherwise, there wasn't that much difference between me and those people they were locking up.
Mm-hmm.
It gave me an empathy that I could never have come up with. A better example is those first three pages of Cuckoo's Nest were written on peyote. And I don't know any Indians. I don't know where that Indian came from. I've always felt humbled by that character. Without the character of that Indian, the book is a melodrama. You know, it's a straight battle between McMurphy and the big nurse. With that Indian's consciousness to filter that through, That makes it exceptional.
Did you find that hallucinogenics would bring out things in your writing, or did you find also that sometimes it would be hard to write when you were high?
Oh, you see a lot of really groovy stuff on hallucinogenics and write it down and 24 hours look at it and realize, you know, I can't even read this. So there were a lot of mistakes made by everybody who thought they were doing wonderful creative works high on drugs, and then later on found that what they were doing was finger painting.
Have you given up drugs, or I don't know, maybe I shouldn't be asking this, but
we're into it now, go ahead.
do you still do them at all? Or?
On religious occasions, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I like to walk up on a mountain on Easter and get a sense of rebirth. Some people jog, some people meditate, you know, there's certain people who whip themselves on the back. Everybody has their own way of trying to see past the veil, and this is just the one that I happened to come up with.
At what point did you decide to give up the kind of prankster's life? The story that I've heard is the pranksters went to Woodstock. You didn't want to go. And when they came back to a sign hung in your driveway that just said, no.
Well, there were 61 people when they headed out to Woodstock. And after they were gone, I went upstairs, and we live in a barn. We still live in the same barn, and we've fixed it up, and it's a pretty nice place. But at that time, there was still hay in the loft of the barn, and I found one of these little hippie warrens where they dug in with their ratty old sleeping bags and their copy of Zap magazine, and stuck right down in the hay bale was a candle, which had burned right down to the hay before it had gone off. And I thought, hey, enlightenment's one thing, but being this loose is, I mean, my grandpa wouldn't allow them up there, my great-grandpa wouldn't have, and there's certain things that take precedent over enlightenment.
Ken Kesey recorded in 1989. He died of liver cancer Saturday at the age of 66. Here's the band that was most associated with Kesey and the Pranksters, the Grateful Dead. This 1972 recording is from a new Dead box set on Rhino Records.
Got my chips cashed in and keep trucking like the dude I'm mayor. Together, more or less in line, just keep trucking. Oh, 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 oh. Heroes of neon and flashing my keys out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's on the same street. Your typical city involved in a typical daydream. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings. Dallas, got a soft machine. Houston, too close to New Orleans. New York, got the ways and means, but just won't let you be.
Coming up, Maureen Carrigan on the Jonathan Franzen-Oprah Winfrey controversy and Jennifer Egan's new novel, Look at Me. This is Fresh Air. Does a famous book club's endorsement on a novel's cover change its identity? Does a new face change a person's essence? Book critic Maureen Carrigan ponders these weighty questions.
Novelist Jonathan Franzen and Oprah Winfrey are just the latest in a long line of artists and their patrons who've bickered on the subject of gratitude. In fact, the outline of their argument is as old as cave painting. Oprah chooses Franzen's recent, much-acclaimed novel, The Corrections, to be featured on her program's book club, which means big bucks for Franzen. Franzen responds by sticking his hand out for the money while sneering at Oprah's middle-brow taste in literature. He moans about how pasting an Oprah Book Club sticker on his novel's cover will threaten his artistic integrity, turning him into just another dray horse in Oprah's stable of writers. Oprah responds by rescinding her invitation to Franzen to be on her show, causing Franzen to do a clumsy full grovel. Both players in this melodrama are taking themselves oh so seriously, and thus they both come off looking like fools. Back in the 18th century, when one of the most notorious artist-patron quarrels erupted, at least there was some elegance to the insults. The specific situation is different, but I'm thinking of the famous letter that Samuel Johnson wrote to his erstwhile patron, Lord Chesterfield, when he, Johnson, was about to publish his monumental Dictionary of the English Language in 1755. Chesterfield contributed £10 to the project, and then, when the dictionary appeared, he wrote an endorsement published in two newspapers that implied he'd underwritten Johnson's years of labor. The irate Dr. Johnson responded, in part, by writing these memorable sentences. 7 years, my lord, have now passed since I waited in your outward rooms or was repulsed from your door, during which time I have been pushing on my work through difficulties of which it is useless to complain. Without one act of assistance, one word of encouragement, or one smile of favor. Is a patron, my lord, one who looks with unconcern on a man struggling for life in the water, and when he has reached ground, encumbers him with help? Now here's how classy Lord Chesterfield was. He kept a copy of Johnson's letter on his library table and would show it to visitors, remarking sincerely, "The man has great powers." No such class or wit is evident in the current tussle. Unlike Franzen, Johnson had the good sense to know that writers need all the support they can get. And unlike Oprah, Lord Chesterfield had the grace to understand that money should defer to talent, however cranky. I confess, for years I've nurtured a fantasy that Oprah's people would call me up and invite me to be her private book critic, helping her to break out of the very suffering and redemption literary rut that Jonathan Franzen has accused her of being stuck in. I guess I've just blown that chance. But if I were reigning this month as Oprah's court critic, I would have recommended to her, on archly bended knee, Jennifer Egan's eerie new novel, Look at Me. Look at Me is shrewdly self-conscious about its qualified salvation story and would surely join The Corrections in what Franzen pompously called the high art literary tradition, if anyone still bothered to keep score. I should really say qualified salvation stories, because Look at Me consists of two intertwined and stylistically experimental narratives, both featuring women named Charlotte. Charlotte Swenson is an almost over-the-hill New York model who crashes her car on a trip back home to Rockford, Illinois, and survives the accident with every bone in her face broken. After two operations and months of swelling, she surfaces a different person. Here's how Charlotte describes her first post-accident visit back to a cafe frequented by her high-fashion friends. People I knew passed my table. Each one looked at me in the particular way people do inside the fashion world. A quick, ravenous glance that demands beauty or power as its immediate reward. And then they looked away, as if what they had seen were not just unfamiliar, but without possibility. The second Charlotte is the 13-year-old daughter of Charlotte Swenson's best childhood friend. She's a mousy thing, overlooked by her parents, whose anxious gaze is fixed on her beautiful younger brother, who's battling leukemia. This neglected teenage Charlotte turns to two men for attention. She becomes the intellectual protege of her mentally disturbed uncle, who's a college professor obsessed with the discovery of clear glass in the 13th century. She also becomes the sexual protege of a stranger named Michael West, who's a fugitive from his own many past lives. Look at Me is so engrossing, energetic, sharp, and funny, it reminded me of Ralph Ellison's masterpiece, Invisible Man, another novel that charts the modernist riddle of human identity. Egan's book only falters towards its very end when a hackneyed terrorist plot twist, of all things, emerges. Egan will probably never get a chance to diss Oprah the way Franzen did. Too bad. Because this is a darkly playful novel that both interrogates our culture of spectacle and revels in it.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Look at Me by Jennifer Egan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. We'll close with some music. This is Billie Holiday's 1954 recording of P.S. I Love You.
Dear, I thought I'd drop a line. The weather's cool, the folks are fine. I'm in bed each night at 9. P.S. I love you. Yesterday we had some rain, but all in all, I can't complain. Was it dusty on the train? P.S. I love you. Ride to the Bronx just as soon as you're able. They came around to call.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with Judd Apatow, the creator of Undeclared, the new Fox TV comedy about a group of college freshmen. Apatow is the executive producer of the high school series Freaks and Geeks. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.